I've been tasked with a difficult opportunity here in the next 25 minutes to review a whole lot of drugs that are really exciting in this disease and that reflect what we just heard about from both Ellie and Rich. And I apologize in advance if I have to skip over some of these drugs in great depth because of the number of drugs that there are to talk about. I guess it's a good problem to have. 20 years ago, if this topic were introduced at the podium and Rich were giving the talk, you'd hear a whole lot about politics and Boston sports, but probably not too much about AML, which can be entertaining, but not the greatest for the patients. So it's nice to be able to talk about some novel agents that really have an impact. So why don't we get started here, and if I can figure out how to get going here. So a lot of these new drugs are being developed across a wide array of indications, and I was asked initially to kind of try to pigeonhole these new drugs towards different disease types, and you really can't do that. Many of these drugs are targeted towards different patient populations and different targets, and even some of the targeted agents themselves are not necessarily helpful in only patients with that particular target. There are off-target effects that we have to think about that probably come into play with agents such as midostaurin and others, where you may have benefit in patients that don't necessarily carry that specific target. But as you can see from this diagram here, many of the new drugs are looking to have an impact in fit patients, in elderly patients, in relapsed patients, patients with specific targets, and others. So I think we're going to see a lot of diversity in how these drugs are used over the years, and there's not going to be one specific population for which any one drug is targeted. Now, hypomethylating agents, I hope everybody here is familiar with. These drugs have really become the mainstay of therapy for high-grade myelodysplastic syndrome, and in large part in acute myeloid leukemia, at least in North America, where we use them as frontline agents for the older patients. And what I'm referring to is primarily 5-azacitidine and decitabine. And I'll just refresh you a little bit on some of the trials that have been done with these agents in older patients with untreated AML. With decitabine, as you may recall, a few years ago, a phase 3 trial was completed that indicated a higher response rate in combination with decitabine compared with investigator's choice for older patients with an AML, but the overall survival did not quite reach statistical significance at the initial landmark analysis, although in later follow-up there seemed to be a significant improvement compared to other agents. Azacitidine followed the same path. You can see here that there was a modest, although not quite statistically significant, benefit in survival for patients who received azacitidine compared with conventional care regimens in AML. So two studies that indicated the utility of these drugs, albeit with a very modest effect. And we've also recognized through the years that hypomethylating agents, despite a lack of randomized trials against other more intensive therapies, probably are just as good, if not better. In this analysis of over 900 patients now from our own institution, and similar data were replicated previously at MD Anderson. In older patients over age 70, we found that the HMA-treated patients actually lived longer than any other group of patients after we did a propensity analysis to match patient characteristics based on what type of therapy they would most likely receive. So HMAs have clearly emerged as a major standard of care for older patients with AML. Now, what about the next steps in hypomethylating agents? I don't think we've reached the ceiling. Certainly, the response rates and the survival are modest, and we can do better, and we are. So, for example, a new drug, guadacitabine, also known as SGI-110, is a next-generation hypomethylating agent, and this is a dinucleotide of decitabine and deoxyguanosine, and this is pharmacokinetically advantageous because this particular compound is resistant to cytidine deaminase, so it sticks around for a lot longer in the circulation and therefore has the advantage of maybe having more of an anti-leukemic effect. And these are data from the MD Anderson group that were presented at ASH about a year and a half ago based upon prior phase 1 data. And in this particular trial of guadacitabine in treatment-naive patients with AML, patients were randomized in the initial phase of the study to receive either the biologically effective dose, in other words, the dose that led to the most robust and reliable demethylation effect, is 60 milligrams per meter squared daily times 5 against the highest well-tolerated dose of 90 milligrams per meter squared. And then at the end of the first phase of the study, they introduced a biologically effective dose given over a 10-day regimen to try to extend that pharmacokinetic advantage. And the primary endpoint was the overall response rate in this phase 2 study. And the results are shown here. If you compare the 5-day regimen to the 10-day regimen, there was really no significant difference. If anything, perhaps a slight improvement in the 5-day outcomes compared to the 10-day outcomes, but not statistically significant. And an impressively high CRI and CRP rate, certainly higher than what you would expect with either azacitidine or decitabine alone. So these data are encouraging whenever you see higher initial response rates. So I'll leave it at that for that drug. You'll be hearing a lot more about that, and there's a randomized phase 3 trial going on right now comparing guatacitabine against investigators' choice of single agent azacitidine or decitabine. The next agent I wanted to talk about is an agent called presinostat. This is an HDAC inhibitor, and HDAC inhibitors are another type of epigenetic modifier that can reinstitute gene expression and perhaps allow for greater recovery of gene expression of silenced genes in AML, such as differentiation genes. And Dr. Garcia Manero has worked extensively with this class of compounds and has done a lot of work in publication. And one of the most exciting compounds coming out lately is this orally bioavailable drug, presinostat, which is a selective inhibitor of class 1, class 2, and class 4 HDAC. And this trial was performed, as shown here, in older patients with previously untreated AML who received both presinostat daily, every other day, and azacitidine for 7 days in a row, every 4 weeks. The primary endpoint, again, was overall response rate, and patients were, generally speaking, older and not candidates for more intensive therapy. The demographics of this study are shown here, as you might imagine. The majority of patients were older than age 70. In fact, most of them were over age 75, and a significant component had secondary or high-risk features in terms of secondary disease that arose from MDS or MPN, and about 40% of patients with poor-risk karyotype as well. The overall response rates are shown here, and again, very intriguingly high response rates in comparison with what you would expect with single-agent azacitidine, decitabine, or low-dose cytarabine, with an overall response rate of CR plus CRI of 46%. The duration of the response, I think, was impressive at over a year, and the time to the marrow complete response was about 60 days, so not a quick-acting agent in combination, but still something that's happening within a couple of months' time. What I think was very impressive about this trial in the preliminary stages was the fact that the median overall survival was 19 months. If you recall, the median survival in the single-arm studies of azacitidine and decitabine were generally less than a year, and the one-year survival at 62%. So these are looking promising as far as perhaps altering the natural history of AML with this combination, and certainly a randomized study will help clarify that question further. So in summary, with the epigenetic agents that we have currently available, we know that they're active as single agents, and they certainly appear to provide similar, if not more, benefit to traditional intensive therapy, although there are really a lack of data to really support one versus the other because the randomized studies haven't been done, comparing 7 plus 3 against azanucleoside therapy. The pharmacokinetically advantageous agents, such as guatacitabine, may offer further advantages and lead to higher response rates and survival. And then secondly, dual epigenetic modifications, such as combining HMAs and HDAC inhibitors, might further augment response rates and overall survival benefit. And hopefully, future randomized studies will allow us to better understand the place in therapy for this combination. So we'll move on now to something else. It's been a project that I've been involved with for a number of years now. And this is a compound called CPX-351, also known as Vyxeos. And the amazing thing about this drug is it's really nothing more than a liposome that encapsulates two very old drugs, daunorubicin and cytarabine. But the beauty of it is that there's a fixed molar ratio between the two drugs, cytarabine and daunorubicin, that is synergistic. And this synergy has been proven in preclinical models. And when you incorporate this synergistic combination at the proper ratio within a liposome, you can actually deliver the two drugs at their intended ratio to the target cell, something you cannot do with free drug cocktail. So just to cut to the chase, we performed phase one and phase two studies that revealed promising results in relapsed and refractory disease, and then a phase two study, a randomized phase two study that showed a survival advantage signal in patients with secondary AML or AML primarily from MDS. So we took it on to a phase three randomized trial in patients with secondary or high-risk AML, comparing CPX-351 against 7 plus 3. We presented these data at ASCO last year, and these were patients over age 60 who were fit. These were not unfit patients, but patients who were fit enough to go through intensive therapy. They were stratified based upon the type of AML they had, MDS-related, adverse cytogenetics or cytogenetics related to MDS, and age as well. Patients went through up to two cycles of induction, followed by up to two cycles of consolidation, and the primary endpoint of the study was overall survival. And I'd like to point out patients in this particular trial were not excluded from receiving a transplant along the way, since we recognize many of these patients would go that route. So the primary results are shown here that we presented last year, and as you can see, there was an overall survival advantage favoring CPX compared to 7 plus 3 by about 3.5 months at the median, and a hazard ratio reduction of 31%, decrease in the risk of death by 31% over the entire course of the study, which was statistically significant. We also wanted to understand how transplant might impact the overall survival advantage seen from CPX, and we did a survival analysis landmarking patients at the time they received a transplant. And as you can see here, data we presented also last year and at ASH as well, that the CPX-treated patients who underwent transplant had a better outcome than transplanted patients who had received 7 plus 3. Again, not a randomized prospective analysis, a subgroup analysis of a larger study, but nonetheless very intriguing and suggesting that maybe with CPX you can achieve a better and deeper response prior to going into a transplant that could lead to better overall responses and results, but these data need to be verified as to the reason why transplant seems to work better in the CPX-treated patients. So in summary, for this part of the talk, I believe that utilizing a novel drug delivery mechanism such as CPX-351 can allow you to augment leukemic cell kill by introducing the proper synergistic ratio into the target cell, which is not achievable with free drug cocktail. CPX-351 is currently at the FDA and will likely gain, I think, approval for secondary or high-risk AML before the end of the year. And this, probably most importantly, is this type of an approach may provide a very important platform for future combination drug development if you can really take advantage of the synergy, whether it's a targeted agent or a more empiric agent. So stay tuned for more on that particular platform. Next, I'll move more into the targeted therapy realm here. We've heard a lot about this so far from our previous two speakers. I'll touch briefly upon FLT3 mutations because Rich went into that in detail. So FLT3, as you know, is a receptor tyrosine kinase that is frequently mutated in AML up to 30% of the time, mostly in the with an internal tandem duplication mutation in the juxtamembrane domain, but occasionally a tyrosine kinase domain mutation can occur as well. And these are leukemias that are characterized by high rates of relapse and overall poor prognosis. And I'll just make brief mention of midostaurin. Rich went into that before, but midostaurin, in my opinion now, is unequivocally the new standard of care for any newly diagnosed patient with AML under age 60 who has a FLT3 mutation either at the ITD or the TKD locus. So what's really interesting also is the development of next generation FLT3 inhibitors that are quite a bit more potent and selective than the earlier generation inhibitors. And these new drugs, such as crenolinib and gilteritinib, which I'll talk about briefly, have the advantage of being able to inhibit FLT3 both in its inactive conformation as well as its active conformation. And when FLT3 mutations develop as a means of resistance to prior FLT3 inhibitor therapy, such as what you may see with midostaurin or sorafenib, they often acquire a D835 mutation that leads to active conformation that these old drugs, can't bind to very well. But the new drugs can actually bind to the active conformation of FLT3 and have an effect. So one of these drugs is crenolinib, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that drug at this meeting and others as well. This is a highly selective type 1 inhibitor. Again, it inhibits both the active and the inactive conformation of FLT3. And without getting into too much nitty-gritty detail, a recent trial was presented by Eunice Wang from Roswell Park at ASH this past year, where patients who had FLT3 mutations at baseline were randomized to either 7+3 plus crenolinib with either idarubicin or daunorubicin, so not really a true randomization in the true sense of the word. But patients were then who went into remission were then treated with high-dose cytarabine plus crenolinib and then went on to receive maintenance with crenolinib. And these were patients, again, with newly diagnosed AML that included patients with secondary AML, and any FLT3 allelic burden was permitted. And these results are indicative of a high response rate, which is not overly surprising for newly diagnosed AML patients, but nonetheless, the majority of patients did achieve remission. Most of them occurred after the first induction, and only a small minority of patients were non-responders, and a significant number of patients went to transplant. And randomized studies are now being conducted with being planned with crenolinib plus daunorubicin and cytarabine in the upfront setting as well. The next drug I'll talk about briefly is gilteritinib. This is another class 1 FLT3 inhibitor that binds to both the active and the inactive conformation of FLT3. And these are data that were presented by Sasha Pearl at ASH this past year. This was a phase 1-2 trial of gilteritinib looking at a variety of doses, ranging from 20 milligrams daily up to 450 milligrams daily. And the doses that are being focused upon right now are the 120 and the 200 milligram dosing cohorts. This was a large phase 1-2 study. And just to summarize the data here, I know the charts are a little bit hard to read, but the take-home message is that in the FLT3 mutated patients, the overall response rate in this relapsed and refractory cohort was almost 50%, including 37% of patients who had either a CR, CRP, or CRI. So a very high response rate for a single agent. But what I thought was even more interesting was that in patients who had previously received treatment with a FLT3 inhibitor, as shown in the bar graph here to the far right, 40% of them actually had responded to gilteritinib after having failed therapy with a prior TKI, suggesting that this is a drug, along with crenolinib, that can overcome resistance-conferring mutations in AML and could be the platform for future earlier therapy to prevent the development of such mutations that leads to FLT3 inhibitor failure. And this is data showing the biologically effective dose as measured by the plasma inhibitory assay developed by Mark Levis at Hopkins, showing that at levels of 120 milligrams a day and higher, you almost have complete inhibition of phospho-FLT3, and this is the basis for carrying forward with these doses in the next generation of trials. So now we have a whole slew of trials testing FLT3 inhibitors in a confirmatory fashion. We have gilteritinib versus salvage therapy for relapsed and refractory disease. We have chemotherapy plus or minus crenolinib in relapsed and refractory FLT3 AML, and quizartinib, which is a class 2 drug. It doesn't bind the active conformation. It binds the inactive conformation, but it's very selective and potent, is being tested against salvage chemotherapy for FLT3 positive relapsed AML as a single agent. So a whole slew of trials that are coming down the pike to really outline what the role of these drugs will be, both in upfront and in relapsed disease. Now, vadastuximab is another targeted agent, and I like to think of this as kind of the new and improved version of gemtuzumab or Mylotarg, and this is an antibody-drug conjugate where you have an anti-CD33 antibody that's conjugated to a very potent compound known as a pyrrolobenzodiazepine dimer that is highly intrinsically binding to DNA and is extremely cytotoxic at higher levels than what you can achieve with calicheamycin, which is the conjugate in gemtuzumab. So this compound has moved forward in a humongous trial, probably the biggest phase 1 trial I've ever been involved with, that has kind of sprouted multiple subsets of trials that's yielded a lot of data in the last couple of years. And one of these subsets within the original trial was looking at vadostuximab as a single agent in patients who were older and treatment naive and who were ineligible or declined high-dose induction therapy. So single-agent therapy for patients with newly diagnosed AML in the older group. Patients received 3-week cycles of vadostuximab at a dose of 40 micrograms per kilogram, which was the preferred dose in this particular trial based on the earlier dose escalation phase. And the results were presented by Dale Bixby at ASH this past year. And as you can see here, an overall response rate that was quite high of 58%. And this included patients that had underlying MDS in their initial diagnosis. These were not patients that had received HMA therapy, so they were also HMA naive, but nonetheless a high response rate in this particular group of patients, which I think is always a very important finding. And most patients had significant blast reduction, and to date, the survival curves are not overly impressive. But nonetheless, the response rates and the blast reduction, I think, provide a platform for a lot more to come. Now, the next breakout group within this large trial was a combination of vadostuximab plus a hypomethylating agent. And these data were presented by Amir Fathi at ASH this year. And these were, again, patients who were previously untreated that had AML that was CD33 positive, who had declined or were not deemed eligible for intensive therapy. And again, no prior HMA therapy was allowed. These patients were treated with azacitidine for at a dose of 75 per meter squared for 7 days, or decitabine at 20 for 5 days, and received 4-week cycles of vadostuximab as part of the treatment regimen. And here are the results. Again, a quite high overall response rate of 73%, which is really much higher than you would expect with azacitidine or decitabine alone. And the response rates held up across different subtypes of AML, including FLT3 and older age group. So stay tuned for a lot more on that drug. We're seeing randomized studies being developed right now for vadostuximab with chemotherapy in younger patients or in combination with azacitidine in a randomized study in older patients. I'd like to touch briefly on another very exciting area. We all know that BCL2 has been a key target for therapeutic development over the past several years based on the importance of BCL2 as an anti-apoptotic protein. And in the case of venetoclax, you can actually competitively bind and replace the pro-apoptotic protein such as BIM or BAX and basically negate the function of BCL2 that allows for apoptosis to take place. The earlier studies done by Dr. Konopleva at MD Anderson in a phase 2 single-agent study showed that there was impressively, I think, high rate of response in relapsed and refractory disease with about 20% of patients responding to this drug as a single agent. And there seemed to be a stronger signal in IDH-mutated AML for reasons that are unclear. And this initial study has paved the way for a number of combination studies, one of which I'll show here. This was presented by Dr. Wei at ASH this past year, combining venetoclax plus low-dose cytarabine. Other studies have combined azacitidine or decitabine with venetoclax as well. And at the recommended phase 2 dose of 600 milligrams was where they expanded the phase 2 component of the study. And as you can see here, again, very high response rates in the older age patient group, especially 70%. And what I think is most important is that the survival curves are looking good. Now, the follow-up is short, but the fact that the one-year survival is hanging out at a fairly high rate is impressive, and I think will be very important in the future of this disease, because certainly overall survival is what we're trying to achieve for these older patients. And I'll finish off here by talking about the IDH inhibitors. And for those of you who may not be familiar, IDH is a very important enzyme in the citric acid cycle. When IDH1 or IDH2 are mutated, you get an abundance and an overproduction of 2-hydroxyglutarate, which then leads to a variety of events intracellularly that lead to a hypermethylation effect in general, and that's felt to be the reason that this mutation class is bad. There are a lot of different mutations that can occur in different tumor types, including AML, MDS, and solid tumors as well. And there are several different inhibitors in clinical development. The two that are, I think, furthest along right now are the Agios compounds, 221 and 120, which we'll talk about briefly. The AG-221 drug, also known as, I don't know how to pronounce this drug, inosinidib, I guess, is basically very far along, another very large phase one and phase two, combined phase one, two study that was run by Eytan Stein at Memorial, and these data have been presented at ASH over the past few years with several hundred patients treated to date. The baseline characteristics are shown here, over 200 patients. They were all, practically all mutated at IDH2, and most of them had relapsed or refractory AML. And the response rates and the overall efficacy shown here, as you can see, there was a 37% overall response rate and about a 20% CR/CRI rate, again, as a single agent in relapsed and refractory disease, pretty good. And a handful of patients were also untreated that did not seem to have any higher of a response rate than in the relapsed group. So very, very strong efficacy in this particular class of compounds. And several of these patients were also able to subsequently undergo allogeneic transplant. So the idea about a bridge to transplant has gained a lot of appeal for these newer agents that are able to get people into remission. AG-120 is the IDH1 inhibitor that's been extensively studied by Courtney DiNardo at MD Anderson, who presented her data also at ASH this past year. Again, a very similar trial in relapsed and refractory AML that was IDH1 mutated. And basically, to again cut to the chase, again, a fairly high and impressive overall response rate of over 30% in the relapsed and refractory group, including 30% who achieved a CR or a CRI. And I mean, for those of you who haven't been doing this for very long, I mean, these numbers are astounding. I mean, we can barely crack 20% in relapsed disease with the best intensive chemotherapy regimens that we've had for years. So the fact that we can get these types of responses with a single oral agent that's generally well tolerated is very impressive. I will point out that the AG-221 drug in particular has been associated with a differentiation syndrome as a toxicity that is in line with its mechanism of action. It's felt to be a differentiating agent in large part. Dr. DiNardo also showed data giving evidence that you could actually clear the IDH1 clone in a significant number of patients who achieved response with this particular compound. So of the patients, of the 14 patients who achieved a complete response, five of them actually had mutation clearance of IDH1. And I think we recognize that mutational clearance, based on what we've heard from our previous speakers, is a very important endpoint in AML and clearly correlates with better outcomes. So we'll be looking to see more details on this in the upcoming months and years. And you can see here graphically how many of these CR patients actually cleared their mutations. But it could take time to do it. It could take up to 6 months to actually clear the mutation, so it's not necessarily a fast-acting drug. So in summary, then, I'm out of time. But fortunately, I don't think anybody here is going to the U2 concert tonight. Maybe I'm wrong. So we have a little bit of flexibility. The next generation HMAs, especially those with favorable pharmacokinetic profiles, such as guadacitabine or even oral azacitidine, which I didn't get into, appear to build upon the previous single agent activity that HMAs demonstrated, and I think will be absolutely indispensable as a future platform for drug development in older adults. Novel drug delivery vehicles such as CPX-351, I think, are going to revolutionize not just AML, but cancer care in general through their ability to deliver two drugs simultaneously at the optimal ratios. And in AML in particular, I think we're going to see a new standard of care for older secondary AML patients within the next few months. FLT3 inhibitors are very active in combination and as single agents in FLT3 mutated disease. Midostaurin is now the standard of care for mutated FLT3 patients who are under age 60, and next-generation inhibitors, very effective as single agents. They can overcome resistance mutations and may provide that proverbial bridge to transplant, which so many of us are looking to as a way to get our patients cured. IDH inhibitors are very strong single-agent actors as well in the relapse setting, also with the potential for bridging to transplant. And the BCL-2 inhibitor approach also appears to be very promising at a more empiric level. You may not need to have a specific target to get an effect, as evidenced by the very high response rates. And the combination of venetoclax and low-dose agents such as HMAs or low-dose cytarabine are showing very promising results and early evidence of prolonged survival. So I've covered a lot of material. I apologize for hitting some of it superficially. And I'll be glad to answer any questions afterward, because I think we have to move on to the esteemed Dr. Garcia-Manero. So.